Ajahn Brahm, many people go and pray to gods, you know, heaven god, kitchen god, whatever god, and, you know, with the idea that the gods are superior to us. But when you read the sutras and encounters with monks like yourself, you realize that, in fact, the gods were coming down to the monks or enlightened beings for teachings. So therefore, you know, are they really superior to human beings like us, or perhaps we have a wrong view of gods?
Okay, we do sometimes have a wrong view of gods, but you know, some gods do have more power in certain areas than we have. For example, that even though that people look upon me as being a wise and powerful monk, whenever I come into Changi Airport, I always make sure I go through the right channels and put in the immigration form properly, because those immigration officers have more power than I have when it comes to coming into Singapore or not. But in certain areas, that devas have more power. But in the area of wisdom, an area of actually mental power, monks have greater power. That's why it is true that sometimes the monks can teach the devas, can teach the gods, and the gods, because of their great respect, will look after and care for those monks, those gods, those monks, those things. Shall I tell a deva story?
Yeah, please.
Which one? Shall I tell you about the Buddha statue which exploded, or the monk who got let into the monastery?
Both.
Okay, some deva stories, real ones. Number one, because sometimes, actually people like miracles, and miracles do happen in all religions. They're not specific to any religion. You know that sometimes we have Buddha statues, powerful ones. This is not superstition, this is real. In the Thai province of Nan, which is on the Mekong River, to the east of Chiang Mai province, it was a very powerful kingdom in its own right, I think 200, 300 years ago. Recently, maybe 30, 40 years ago, yeah, about 30, 40 years ago, in the chief monastery of the capital of Nan province in Thailand, an American visitor came to look for a Buddha statue to take home. In the monastery, they had many statues, and they were short of cash, like many monasteries, even in Singapore today. And this particular American asked the abbot, "Is there any Buddha statue which you don't want here? You've got so many. Can I take one back to you, the States with me?" And of course, there were so many Buddha statues in the monastery, and they needed something for their building project, some money. So they said, "Sure, you know, as long as it's, you know, reasonable statues, one we don't really need, sure we can." So the American chose an old stone statue in the courtyard. Not a particularly beautiful one. So the monk said, "Oh yeah, sure, you can have that one." They agreed upon a price. And the American was to come back the following day with the money to take the Buddha statue away. That night, the deputy abbot had a dream. Basically, the dream says, "Do not sell that statue." So in the morning, the deputy abbot went to see the head abbot and said to him, "Look, I had this dream. It was very, very vivid. We shouldn't sell that statue." And like many Singaporeans and Thais, dreams like that they take seriously. And so they decided, when the Americans came, said, "Sorry, the deal is off. We can't sell you that statue." And the American was actually quite understanding. He went somewhere else to get a statue. There's many monasteries. So the deal was off. Because of the dream, the abbot and the deputy decided to do an act of forgiveness towards that Buddha statue. They got a tray of candles, flowers and incense, according to the Thai Buddhist tradition. And they held it there. They were about to chant the words of asking forgiveness, but first of all, they bowed in front of that Buddha statue in the courtyard. when the head first hit the ground, it was a bang! Just like that.
You always do that.
I do, yeah. It's great. Because it keeps people awake. Sometimes people go to go asleep. I haven't got many visual effects, but you know, this is special effects on Ajahn Brahm's talks. Anyhow, the statue went bang. Exploded. They never touched it. They were, you know, about a meter or 2 meters away from the statue. And they were obviously stunned. And they looked at it, and the outer casing was cracked. Inside, a solid gold Buddha statue. A huge one. During the Burmese invasion of Thailand, many monasteries, to prevent their statues from being taken away, covered it with plaster and disguised it as worthless stone statues and just left it in the grounds. That was one of them. And the 200 years, everyone had forgotten what that statue was. It was solid gold inside. And now it's in the main temple in Nan. They don't need security, it's just too heavy for anything to take away. And that was told by the head monk a few years ago. The deputy abbot soon became the abbot and tells that story of the history of that statue. How did it explode? No one touched it. But there are such things as devas who guard these things. They're the ones who gave them the dream. Say, do not take that Buddha statue away. It's special. And it was. Solid gold inside. So if ever you hear a bang and you're... Have a look at your Buddha statue. You might... Story number two. It's almost like directly from the time of the Buddha. But this is very recent. Only 20 years ago, 25 years ago. I've told this story before to some people. It's been confirmed by the former Thai ambassador to Singapore, because I told him this story at the embassy in Orchard Road some time ago. And he said, yeah, that's true. I've heard that too. But I also heard this from the monk. There was a young American 20 years ago in the Peace Corps. After serving a couple of years in the Peace Corps, he decided to try the life of a monk. He'd seen the monks, understood a little bit about Buddhism, and thought, yeah, this is what I want to do now, just to test it out. But he did not know how you become a monk. What are you supposed to do? He was staying in a hotel in Bangkok, so he asked a concierge. You know, the concierge is supposed to know everything. So he said, look, I want to become a monk, what do I do? And the concierge knew of one monastery in Bangkok, it's called Wat Buwon, where there's often Western monks. So he said, well, that's probably the best place for you to go. It was actually the royal monastery, at that time the Sangharaja of Thailand's monastery, very close to the central field in central Bangkok. He said, go there early in the morning, take some food, and when the monks come out on their arms round, put some food into the monk's bowl and ask the monk, you know some Thai, they may be able to say something in Thai, I want to be a monk, what should I do? And they will actually look after you. So, he said, okay. He got some food, got in the taxi, got to this monastery very early in the morning. Too early, it was about 4 a.m. The whole monastery was closed, was locked up. No one was around. It was still dark. He didn't know what to do. So he's walking up and down outside, wondering what to do, when this man approached him and asked him who he was, what he wanted. And when this young American said, look, I want to be a monk, and I was told to come here, but it's all closed. And this man told this young American, the monastery won't open for another hour or two. But it doesn't matter, I've got the key, I can let you in. So he opened up the gates, took this young man in, and he opened up the door to the main hall in this monastery. It's called the Bodh Upasata Hall. And this is a very special building. This is like the Holy of Holies in this monastery. This is where the kings of Thailand are ordained as monks. It's a very special royal ordination hall. And like many Thai temples, on the walls are many murals. After turning on the electric lights, this man, this Thai man, explained to the American in great detail the meaning of all those Thai murals. Not only what they represent and who the figures were, but actually even the people who sponsored those paintings and why they sponsored it. And the American said it was just an incredible story, and it was just so interesting. And the minutes passed, and when it got roughly to the last mural, this Thai man said, "Well, look, the monks are going to come out soon. If you stand over there, this monk, I know him, he comes out there, he's one of the senior monks, he'll be able to help you become a monk. You go and stand over there with your food, I'll turn the lights off and lock up," which he did. And the monk stood there, just as he was explained. A few minutes, a senior monk came out, this young American put some food in a bowl and asked in broken Thai, "You know, I want to become a monk." The monk understood, said, "Go in here, I'll be back soon. I'll meet you here and I'll take you to the abbot and we'll start off the process." So he started off the process of training to be a monk. And of course there's lots to learn, not just the chanting for being a monk, but also some of the rules. And so he was assigned a Thai monk to tell him all the rules and the procedures. But after a week or so, the American got frustrated because this Thai monk assigned to him could not speak good English. So he said, "Isn't there someone better who can teach me in English?" And the other monk said, "This is our best monk. He's one who can speak English the clearest." "Is that all you've got?" "Yes." And this American thought, "What about that lay attendant, the one I met on the first day who let me in?" "What lay attendant?" said the monks. "The monk who opened up this gate and took me into the main hall." The monk immediately took him to the abbot, because no lay person has the key to that gate, and also no one other than the king of Thailand enters by that gate. It's the king's gate. Only a couple of monks have the key to that main hall. You can't turn on the electric lights there. They took him to the abbot. They started telling him the story. The abbot, the present Sangharaja of Thailand, stopped him and said, "Get the secretary, because it's true. That gate, no one has the key except, I think, the Sangharaja himself, maybe the secretary. You can't open. You can't turn on the lights where we're supposed to have turned on the lights. And not even the abbot knew the stories of all of those murals. They wrote it all down." They asked this young American, "What did that Thai man look like?" He said he was wearing old traditional Thai dress. "But can you explain his features? The features of this person who opened gates which only kings are supposed to pass through, with keys which he doesn't have. A person who can switch on electric lights where you can't. A person who can open the door to the main Upasata Hall, the main ordination hall, when only monks have those keys. Who can explain the stories behind these murals, which not even the oldest monk, the abbot, knew. Who was this person?" It's hard to describe what a person looks like, his features. But as the American was looking around trying to think, he saw him on the wall. That was him. King Rama V. King Mongkut. who died over, was it 120, 130, 40 years ago? One of the main sponsors of that temple. Of course he could open that door, because he was a king. Of course he knew about the meaning of those paintings, because it was him and his family who sponsored them. A modern story of a heavenly being, a former king of Thailand, who helped a young Westerner who wanted to become a monk achieve his aspirations. That's a true story as it happened. A heavenly being. They won't help someone get into a casino, but it will help someone get into a monastery.
Now, Ajahn Brahm, how can you tell whether the king in that form was a ghost or a deva?
Because ghosts, they don't help people. They just scare the pants off people. Ghosts go, ooh! Could they always help you? They do good things.
Thank you. I think there's a gentleman there with a question.
Been waiting a long time, yeah.
Ajahn Brahm, I have one question to ask. Just now Ajahn Brahm said that the Buddha didn't teach Abhidharma. Do you mind to elaborate more? Thank you.
Okay, to elaborate more is evidence number one. In the story of the first council, after the Buddha passed away, after his parinirvana, that one of the monks was heard to say, "Oh great, the Buddha has died now. Now we don't have to keep all those rules." And one of the monks heard that and said, "Look, the Buddha's only been passed away just a short time. And even now, the monks are not respecting the Vinaya, the rules which the Buddha laid down. I think we should meet together very quickly, actually, to formulate what these rules are, to agree as a whole community, and also to collect all the teachings into one." And you can read this, that's in the Chulawaga of the Kandakas of the Vinaya Pitaka. In the story which is repeated in all the main traditions of Buddhism, Venerable Ananda, who was the... Oh no, so let's start first. Venerable Pali, who was the Vinaya expert, he recited the Vinaya. And the other monks questioned him as he was reciting it to make sure that everything was remembered correctly and actually could be kept for posterity. Venerable Pali recited the Vinaya, starting at the Paratikas and finishing with the minor rules. Afterwards, it was Venerable Ananda recited the suttas. The reason was that for the last 25 years of the Buddha's life, Venerable Ananda was the attendant, the constant companion. And he had such a great memory that he recalled many of the teachings. What obviously he didn't remember, other monks would and would help him. He recited, according to this ancient document, the Pancha Nikaya, the five Nikayas, which everybody today knows as the Digha Nikaya, the Majjhima Nikaya, the Sanyutta Nikaya, Anguttara Nikaya, and Kudaka Nikaya. No mention of Abhidhamma. That's number one. Originally there was only Dvipitaka, two Pitakas, two collections, Vinaya and Suttas. In another place, in the Gaudisana Sutta, in the Majjhima Nikaya, there we're talking about the forest monk. And the Buddha was admonishing forest monks for being diligent. They say one of the things that the forest monk should know is Abhivinaya and Abhidhamma. Because he said that of all people, the forest monk should know Abhivinaya and Abhidhamma more than anybody else. Because people come and ask you questions, they'd expect you to know more. Abhivinaya, there's no books called Abhivinaya. Abhivinaya was like the teachings of restraint, not just keeping the rules, but keeping more than the rules, a greater simplicity than is required by the rules. Like the precepts, even the five precepts, to be a good person, you have to do more than just keep the precepts, more than just not kill, not steal, not commit adultery, not lie, not take alcohol and drugs. You have to be compassionate, kind and generous. It's a greater degree of goodness beyond the precepts. Abhivinaya is a greater degree of simplicity and restraint than required by the monk's rules. And the forest monks should have that. And the Abhidhamma was not some collection of teachings. What the forest monks would know more than the city monks was the deep Dhamma gained through meditation, not through study, but through experience of the mind in stillness and the insights which come from that. The use of the term Abhidhamma in the Gurisana Sutta, attributed the experts being the forest monks, not the city monks, shows me the Abhidhamma was not some texts, not some academic studies, but experiential knowledge. And lastly, I always refer people to Indian Buddhism by Professor A.K. Warder of Cambridge University. I'm not being partisan to fellow Cambridge people, but he wrote probably the classic book which answers the question, what did the Buddha teach? And he used the analysis of language to decide. Arguments such as, to explain this, if you read a book and you heard the word, say, gay, and if it described sort of a person who was having a happy time with his wife and children, you'd realize that that book must have been written maybe 30 years before or earlier. Because the word gay has changed its meaning. Now it means like homosexual. Before it was anybody who was having a happy time. Because words change their meaning over time, we can actually place a text in the period in which it was written by the language and the style. If ever you read, say, Charles Dickens and you read a modern novel, the words, the vocabulary, the style is very different. That's actually how we can date literature. And he used such dating techniques on Tipitaka, Vinaya, Suttas, Abhidhamma, actually to date the Abhidhamma maybe about a couple of hundred years after the Parinibbana of the Buddha. Maybe the beginnings, maybe 100 years, but most of it much later. So there's lots of evidence there. And I got to bend the beliefs to fit the facts. So that's three pieces of evidence there.
Oh okay. Dear. We've got quite a few people on the other side.
Okay, yeah. Okay, let's go.
Okay. We're going to have to keep the questions short.
Okay, and the answer's
because
short.
Tomorrow's a working day, so we're going to end the session by 9:30. Yes.
Okay, just now you mentioned about we as creators, we have the power to change things. But I've also read from some other books that our soul has chosen certain blueprint in this lifetime to do certain things. So certain things are probably not meant for us, and how do you actually strike a balance between us as a creator and what we have planned before we came here?
I don't know about your plans. Mine are constantly changing. We adapt. And I don't know, what did you plan for your life? Did it work out as you expected? Or is your life just constantly being amended day by day?
Yeah, it's changing.
Yeah, that's actually our life. So there are certain tendencies in our life. Well, you can change anything these days. You're a woman, if you really want to, you can...
become a man?
I never said that, but I went for you. But there's so much you can change. So that we do actually start off with a direction in life. But we can always amend that direction. And I think this is so important in our life, because sometimes people say, I'm poor, I'm destined to be poor. I just have to take it as being poor. No, it's no. you can change. Or sometimes people, maybe they don't do well at school. They say, oh, I haven't got what it takes to go to school. I'm dumb. You know, one of my friends, I saw him in Boston last couple of months ago. He was a monk with me when I was young. I don't know if he graduated from high school. He was pretty dumb at school anyway, and eventually he joined the army as a helicopter pilot in Vietnam. But he probably had the best command of Thai and Lao of all of our monks. He eventually disrobed, and I was stunned when I heard he went to Harvard and graduated with, a master's in psychology. This guy who didn't finish high school went to Harvard. What it showed me is that if you really want to, you can do anything. It's your belief, your confidence, your hard work, keeping on going, never giving up. In other words, your karma. So this is a wonderful positive message. It's not just being positive just to cheer people up. This is basic Buddhism. It's not God's plan. If it was God's plan or your destiny or whatever, you'd have no hope. You'd have to just accept your position, your marriage, your job, your cancer. Oh, it's just meant to be. No, do something about it.
Thank you.
Okay, I would appreciate if all of you remain seated, because we will finish very shortly, and be nice for people not to be distracted by you having to cross them.
Good evening, Ajahn Chah. I have a question on cloning. As the technology and cloning and genetic engineering gets better, we can almost produce a superior or physically superior being. Is this, I would imagine this is part of human evolution. Some religion, particularly Christianity, does not agree with cloning or genetic engineering. As Buddhists, what's your view on that?
Well, as my Buddhist is actually, essentially, we have to go for it, and we will go for it. We always have gone for it. You know, sometimes, apparently, after Benjamin Franklin basically discovered the lightning conductor, there was a huge uproar in Christian United States at the time not to put lightning conductors on buildings, because this was preventing God punishing sinners with lightning. It's true. Read your history. It's crazy, but obviously people said, no, it's important that we do this to save lives. Compassion is always stronger than religion. And it's an amazing thing to see, despite your religious beliefs or lack of them, there's a heart which moves when it sees, like, someone who's been paralyzed, say an accident where there's an 8-year-old and can't walk. And there's a possibility of using, say, stem cells. I don't know if it's a possibility, but where there's a possibility, there's usually hope. And where there's hope, there's work. And where there's work, eventually there's some sort of success. This is what miracles are. We make those miracles. And I can't see anything wrong with this, in essence. Where I am concerned is when the technology is there and it's misused. In other words, either for profit or for exploitation or whatever. In and of itself, with right ethical safeguards, it's a wonderful thing to do. To be able to help human beings, to heal diseases, stem cell research is a wonderful thing to do.
What about in terms of cloning of a human being then?
Cloning of a human being, if one does, well, what is one cloning it for? What's the purpose of it? In and of itself, there's no problem there. But I don't know, it's just we have enough human beings which are conceived in the normal way. We don't want to clone any more. But the point is, whatever you clone, it doesn't turn out the way you expected it to be turned out. If we cloned you, it would not look the same. It looks similar, but maybe not the same. And also that you would not be the same being, because the stream of consciousness, what other religions call the soul, there's a slight difference there, but, you know, for this argument here, hardly any difference. That will change the being. So you may have a clone of you, but it will be completely different. If they cloned Ajahn Brahm, he probably wouldn't turn out to be a monk. He'd probably be a, I don't know, sort of a street sweeper or, I don't know,
rock star.
Bus driver.
Thank you.
So there's no ethical problem there at all.
Thanks.
To decide ethical questions, you always go back to the Buddha's advice to Ananda. Is this going to help yourself and other beings, or is it going to harm them?
Okay, the last question.
No, give me one more, please. After him. Please, okay. Please. Very important question.
Okay, a very okay. Quick one then.
Okay.
Good evening, Ajahn Brahm. I'm not a Buddhist, but I'd like to know, is there such thing as bad karma? Because just now you're saying that other religions, they have a fear, because they fear to go to hell and everything. That's why they believe. So does Buddhism have that also? Is bad karma also make people believe they need to do good?
Yeah. Bad karma, is such a thing as bad karma? Whatever hurts or harms another person or hurts or harms yourself is bad karma. Expanding it that way, you're harming, you're hurting yourself and others. It's a mistake which we make. But the wonderful thing about Buddhism, a bad karma, you can alleviate it, you can forgive it. You don't need someone else to do that for you. You don't need to come up to Ajahn Brahm, to some priest or some statue or some god, and say, please, please forgive me. In Buddhism, forgiveness should be yourself. Which is why for many years now I've taught the AFL code, acknowledge your mistakes. Forgiving means no punishing is necessary. So we don't fear punishment. We're mature enough to know we've done something wrong and to realize creating more harm or hurt, more pain, doesn't help. No more than having revenge on someone who hurts you will stop the problem. We acknowledge, we forgive, and the last L is to learn. So bad karma is making mistakes in life. Sure, it creates pain. We can learn from that. So we make those mistakes less and less and less. And the only reason we go to hell is because we send ourselves down there. We create our hells. We do that. Because we are the creator of our hells, we can also escape from those hells. So our wisdom, compassion, this time towards ourselves. Forgive. This, the title of my book, Open the Door of Your Heart, is precisely for that reason. Open the door of your heart to yourself. Don't give yourself more pain. Forgive. And this is basic teachings from the mouth of the Buddha. The Buddha said to even people who try to kill him, if you acknowledge your faults, make amends, and learn from them, that's called growth in Buddhism. And even people who make mistakes. There was this guy when I was in the United States, his name was Tookie. He was one of the founders of the Crips gang in San Francisco. He'd actually killed a couple of people, but being put on death row in St. Quentin for many years, he had written books. He'd been a great influence on the youth not to go into gangs, not to take the drugs. He was such a positive influence to the street gangs or people who would have been in the street gangs in San Francisco in a positive way, keeping kids out of that cycle of crime. The former governor of San Quentin sort of wrote to Arnie Schwarzenegger, please, there's no point to killing this guy. Okay, you know, maybe not be able to be released, keep him in jail, but he's doing too much good work. He's priceless. No one else can do this. Why kill him? The end of December, he was executed. What a waste. Just because of revenge. And that was a classic case of the thirst for revenge. The consequence of that is to be a huge number of other street kids go on to San Francisco in lives of crimes where this guy who was kept alive could have stopped them.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right.
Please share with us as much as you can. Who are Jesus Christ and His Heavenly Father the God and creator of this universe as stated in the Bible. How are they related to Buddhism and other religions? And which level of heavens are they residing now? Thank you.
Again, because I was brought up as a Christian and I've read the Bible and I've researched the Bible and know my history, it's very hard to say which Bible, because there are several Bibles. The Orthodox Christianity has one Bible, the Catholics have another, the Protestants have another, and they have evolved. If anyone's really interested in this, read a bestseller called The History of God by Karen Armstrong. The History of God by Karen Armstrong. She was a former Catholic nun. I think she still is a Christian. It's a great book. You probably find it even in the major bookstores here in Singapore. She knew what she was talking about because she was raised as a Christian, still is a Christian, a Catholic nun who went to Oxford and did, I think, a degrees in philosophy or whatever, a PhD. And she is an expert on exactly these types of questions. Exactly who was Jesus? Exactly what was Christianity? What's his relationship to God? It's a fascinating story which will take hours to talk about. But one interesting piece of information about the connection between Buddhism and Jesus is that in Alexandria, over 2,000 years ago, this is according to Philo of Alexandria, who was a historian and commentator 2,000 years ago. He wrote in Greek. He recorded the existence of a monastery in Alexandria. Alexandria, in the mouth of the Nile, one of the major European cities 2,000 years ago, where Cleopatra, you know, had her palace. He recorded a monastery called the Therapeutai. The monks had bald heads, wore brown robes, were vegetarians. He didn't know who they were. There were no monks of such description in the Jewish religion, which was dominant at the time. This was before or round about the birth of Christ, of Jesus. Who were they? They also said there were thousands of these other monks further down the Nile. It's quite clear to actually, straight away, as many other commentators have said, that must have been Buddhist monks. One of my fellow monks, who was fluent in Greek from Switzerland, I told him this once, and he said, "Ah, no, come on, Ajahn Brahm, that's not true. You know, you can't just have this idea that Buddhism was in Alexandria 2,000 years ago." But I was actually said, "Well, look, you know ancient Greek. Next time you're in Zurich, go to the library and find out." So he did. And I remember this letter he wrote back. "I apologize, Ajahn Brahm. I read it in the original Greek. This, in his words, a dead ringer for Buddhist monks." And as other people have said, Therapeutai is a corruption of the word Theravada. P's and V's, T's and D's get exchanged in the course of history from land to land. Thousands of other monks further down the Nile. If any of you look in your history and see the course of trade between India and the Mediterranean, most of the ships went from the port of Soparica, which was, I think, just to the south of present-day Bombay, Mumbai, and they went across the Persian Gulf. One of the spots on the way was the ancient port of Aden. They went up the Red Sea, and the short trip across the land between the Red Sea ended and to Alexandria before the Suez Canal. That was one of the major, if not the major, trade routes of 2,000 years ago. The traders from India, just like where many of the Chinese came from Singapore, traders, where the English, the Ang Mo's came from Singapore, traders. With the traders, you bring your religious people, where all the pastors came from. They came with the ships when the English first came to Singapore. Surely, this is what happened there as well. The traders, there was an Indian quarter on the maps of Alexandria 2,000 years ago. A little, you can see the maps in the museums. Indian quarter, just like there's a Chinatown in many cities. The expats from India had their towns, they would have had their monks. When it said thousands of monks further down the Nile, obviously in that direction was India. That was Indian monks, Theravada monks in Alexandria 2,000 years ago. According to the many versions of the Bible, after the birth of Jesus, there was a persecution by Herod, and the whole family fled to Egypt, where Jesus grew up. It does not say what town in Egypt Jesus went to, but I think it's a fair assumption that any refugee goes to the major city, the capital, which was Alexandria. So it is quite feasible that Jesus grew up in Alexandria, where there was a thriving Theravada Buddhist monastery. Who knows? Isn't it possible, if not probable, that anybody who was interested in spiritual matters would have actually visited that temple, which was well respected by everybody in that city? That's why there are many other versions of Christianity. And one which I have always been fascinated with is what Elaine Pagels, Professor Elaine Pagels, that's P-A-G-E-L-S, describes, she calls it suppressed Christianity, what I first heard as the Gnostic Gospels, which were found at the city, at the town of Narq Hamadi in Lower Egypt about 45, 50 years ago. Ancient teachings which were ascribed to a person called Jesus. In the Gnostic Gospels there are some interesting passages. One of which, because of what I said earlier, you probably remember, recall. This is in the Gnostic Gospels. I think it's in the Gospel of St. Thomas. Gnostic Gospels, Elaine Pagels. God was in his heaven saying, I am the chief, the firstborn, the Lord of all that is, and so on. And a voice says, no, you're not. And God says, who said that? Who said that? I don't know who said that. And it says, God, there are other beings in this universe you're not aware of. Don't get above yourself. That's in the Gnostic Christian Gospels found at Narq Hamadi, dating from at least the first or second century of this era. A very early form of Christianity called Gnostic Christianity by the professors. He who knows the truth of themselves knows the truth of all things. A saying of Jesus in the Gnostic Christian Gospels. Does that sound like a common teaching of all religions? Now that's a fascinating part of Christianity which I think people should actually look at more. So who was Jesus? There is a whole huge area of information we should look at. Not just the Roman Catholic Bible or the Orthodox Christian Bible or the King James, the sixth version of the Bible, but the whole range of teachings which have come down to us by that man, from that man. And these Gnostic Gospels, as Elaine Pagel said, suppress Christianity. We should actually open it up. And once we actually see what a great person like Jesus would have taught, then I think the Buddhists, Muslims, Hindus can say, wow, that was a very wise person. Yeah, we can accept that. Doesn't that make sense? He or she who knows the truth of themselves knows the truth of all things. Or, as it says in the Psalms, one of my favorite quotes from Christianity, be still and know that thou art God. Be still. Meditate.
Thank you, Ajahn Brown. That was an incredible ending. And thank you for the question.
Thank you.